When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Hello and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Satanic Panic. I could talk about this phenomenon for days. I grew up in it. I was raised in it. When I was a kid, the devil was everywhere, just waiting to get you. Our little rural town in Utah had not one, but two devil worship houses, just abandoned houses, really. And the stories about what happened in those houses ranged from drugs to animal sacrifice to witchcraft and murder. Satanic Panic was an integral part of 1980s America, and it shaped the way we see that era. Every time something bad happened or a crime was committed, the talk show hosts and the talking heads on TV tried to tie it to devil worship. They blamed rock music, they blamed horror movies, they blamed Dungeons and Dragons, and they blamed drugs. Satanism was everywhere in the 1980s, and there were a lot of kids who jumped on the bandwagon, dressing in band t-shirts with black eyeliner, and in my town, those knee-high lace-up moccasin boots. Who remembers those? Devil worship was a really big part of the conversation in the 1980s, and a lot of kids really bought into it. One of those kids got swallowed up by Satanic Panic, and before long, he was lost in it. His obsession had fatal consequences for not only him, but for those around him. This is the case of Ricky Casso, the Acid King. Let's get into it. 1983. A 15-year-old boy named Richard Casso, who went by Ricky, was starting to struggle. He was a student at Cold Spring Harbor High School in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, which is near Huntington, near the North Shore of Long Island. Ricky's father was a high school history teacher and the football coach at the school where Ricky attended. His mother was also a teacher at the high school. Ricky's father forced him to play on the football team, but Ricky wasn't a great athlete. Also, he hated football. When he was younger, he had enjoyed it, but Ricky had changed pretty dramatically. When you read the surface articles about Ricky Casso and about this case, you get the impression that Ricky became a wayward teen whose parents just didn't know what to do with him. When you dig deeper and you listen to the people who knew him and who knew his family, Ricky was abused. I watched interview after interview with people who had firsthand experience, even with people who were students of Ricky's father, and not one of them had anything good to say about Richard Casso Sr. Like all the other kids, Ricky was into heavy metal music and partying on the weekends, but Ricky had a very dark side. While other kids in the area would smoke pot once in a while or experiment with other drugs, Ricky was immersed. He was obsessed with drugs and he took anything he could get his hands on. He seems like he was one of those people who, once he got a taste, he couldn't get enough. I know people like that. We don't have the science to understand it at this point, but I personally believe that there are people whose biology makes them prone to be addicts. That's my opinion. And Ricky, he loved drugs. After reading and watching a lot about Ricky Casso, my opinion is that he was, in fact, a very sensitive kid who had a very abusive father and maybe even mother, and he turned to drugs to take him out of his sad reality. He turned to drugs to numb the pain of his home life. Ricky started to go downhill fast. He was high almost all the time, and his parents, especially his father, had had enough of him. Ricky was obviously in need of serious help. Instead, he got berated and yelled at and neglected. There were a lot of kids going through what Ricky was going through back then. I mean, there still are. But back then there was no help, nowhere to go. I had friends looking back that were being abused, but I didn't know it at the time. I had a good home life, and I didn't recognize or know what that darkness was in some of my friends. But I know that they sure didn't have anybody to talk about it with. Ricky's father was always kicking him out of the house. People in the area knew Ricky often needed money and a place to stay. Other people talked about how they would be shocked to find out that Ricky was sleeping in someone's yard or in their shed, but no one did anything about it. You didn't call CPS back then. There was no school counselor to turn to. Well, not one that would do anything but go right to your parents and tell them you were complaining about them anyway. One day after Ricky had been out of the house for a few days, he came home and asked his father for a quarter to buy a bagel. Ricky hadn't eaten for quite some time, and his father wouldn't even give him that. Ricky got angry, and he kicked his father's car and dented it. His father flew into a rage, and then he went in the house and got $2, gave them to Ricky, and told him never to come back. He told him he was never to speak to his mother or his sisters again. Oh, that makes me angry. You bring a child into this world, you have a responsibility, period. Even when they're difficult and hard to love. At only 15 years old, Ricky began living in the woods or in his friends' cars, backyards, garages, anybody that would let him crash anywhere. That's where Ricky was at. I'm sure it's really tough on parents of kids like Ricky, but I just strongly feel you don't throw them out on the street. 15 years old is too young for that. And even though Ricky ends up doing some really awful things, I can't help but feel sorry for him. For a lot of people in this story, actually. Ricky was friends with a group of guys, and they kind of started this little gang. They called themselves the Knights of the Black Circle. There were four main members: Ricky, his really good friend Jimmy, a guy named Albert Quinones, and another named Gary Lowers. They sold pot and they hung out and listened to music, and locals began accusing them of killing their pets in the woods. There really was no proof that this was happening, but this was all part of the satanic panic mentality. Ricky's pot sales got him enough money to buy harder drugs, and soon he was taking LSD and PCP and purple microdots that he said were mescaline, but they were actually more like low-quality LSD. Ricky was off his face most of the time. Now, like I said, Ricky had this really close friend named Jimmy Troiano. Jimmy had already been in and out of juvenile detention and even jail. Ricky and Jimmy would often go into the woods and drop acid. They would tell people that the trees melted and the sky opened up. And then Ricky began to tell people he was talking to the devil. When friends pressed him to tell them more, he would say, "I can't tell you, you'll think I'm crazy." Ricky started reading everything about the devil and Satanism that he could get his hands on. He stole books on the occult and read up on how to cast spells and offer sacrifices. He met up with other kids into the same thing, and together they started participating in occult ceremonies near Northport. In the spring of 1984, they even went together to Amityville, New York for Walpurgis Night. Walpurgis Night is a pagan holiday to celebrate fertility and the coming of spring. It's celebrated around the end of April. Well, like with a lot of things in paganism, people think it is associated with the devil. So Ricky and his friends went to Amityville, where the Amityville murders had taken place, and celebrated the night there. Ricky started carrying around a copy of Anton LaVey's book, The Satanic Bible, and friends report he was pretty obsessed with Satanism. So just kind of picture this. You've got this teenage boy, who everyone in the area knows is on drugs and obsessed with the devil, living alone out in the woods, most of his time in this little abandoned shack. He's supposedly killing the neighborhood pets, and yet other kids are just going out there to hang out with him. I mean, that's a very 80s story. If you're from the 80s, you know. It was a much, much freer time, but a much more dangerous time in a lot of ways. But anyway, that visual just kind of really puts a point on the inspiration for a lot of 80s horror movies, doesn't it? At some point, Ricky's parents were contacted by people who were very concerned about him. They intervened, and he was admitted to the South Oaks Psychiatric Hospital, which used to be called the Amityville Asylum, a much better name in my opinion. He was going in there to be treated for his drug use and for psychiatric treatment. Neither of those treatments seemed to help Ricky at all. When he got out, Ricky was arrested for vandalizing and digging up a colonial-era grave inside the local cemetery. He told people that he was looking for a skull to use in his ceremonies. He was caught, and while he was awaiting trial, he got really sick. It started as a cold, and soon he had pneumonia. At now only 16 years old, Ricky Casso's life was falling apart. He was even losing his health at such a young age. He had to be hospitalized to treat his pneumonia. And while at Long Island Jewish Hospital, his parents kind of quietly went to the doctors and tried to convince them to involuntarily commit Ricky to a psychiatric hospital. His parents did seem to care about him on some level. They tried to step in from time to time, but Ricky was on a downward spiral, an ice luge, really. The doctors at the hospital said that yes, Ricky exhibited antisocial behavior, but he was not psychotic and they didn't feel he was a danger, so he was released after his pneumonia was treated. He quickly linked back up with his main group of friends and they went back to their usual routine. Jimmy got arrested at some point and was sentenced to 8 months, so he spent a lot of time away from the group, but was then released and when he got out, he was a little bit worse for wear. Jimmy was known as a kid that had scars all over his face, and the kids kind of came up with all of these stories about how he put a hook in his mouth and tore his cheek, and I mean, who knows what happened to the kid. They were rough kids. They had a rough life. The kids were pretty out of control. They had little to no supervision, and they were taking hard drugs. As I researched this story, it really began to feel like a runaway train, and well, we know there's only one way a runaway train stops. And that's with disaster. One night, the Knights of the Black Circle threw a party in the woods. Other people from the area joined the party, and apparently it was a rager. Ricky was known to have really cheap acid and PCP on him all the time. He sold it for really cheap, and he always had a lot of it on him. That night at the party, he got so high that he passed out completely. While Ricky was unconscious, Gary Lowers, one of the members of his little crew, walked over to Ricky's unconscious body and took 10 bags of PCP off him. Gary then gave out 5 bags to people at the party, and then Ricky woke up. If you've been around a dealer, you know, they always know exactly how much they have on them. And even though Ricky was zooted all the time, he still knew someone had taken his drugs. And then for some reason, I think some kids told him, he found out it was Gary. Ricky confronted Gary, who admitted that yes, he had taken the 10 bags. He told Ricky 5 were gone and that he would pay Ricky the $50 for those 5 bags, and then he returned the remaining 5 bags to Ricky. Gary did end up paying Ricky that $50 back that he owed him, but it seemed like it was deeper than that. Gary had ripped Ricky off, and it almost seems like Ricky was hurt about it. A few days went by and Ricky and Gary got into a physical altercation where Gary was beaten up really badly. This happened again and again over the next couple of weeks. The two were still hanging out together, but a lot of times the nights ended in a beating for Gary. Gary was a kid very much like kids we all knew in school. One month they're into rap music and the next month they're into heavy metal. They change their hair and their clothes a lot and they seem like they're a little bit lost. You know those kids. They don't have a great group of friends and they're kind of trying to float between groups, trying to find a place to fit in. That was Gary. For some reason, they called him Fuzzy Legs. He was known as kind of a dorky kid who was suddenly seen as tough because he got into Satanism. As I'm telling this story, I am picturing like 5 or 6 kids that I went to school with that were exactly like Gary, but one in particular. He was a really, really nice kid, and he floated between groups, and then all of a sudden he came to school dressed like he was in Motley Crue. I mean, like, I'm talking full makeup, I'm talking like lightning bolt skin type pants with like belts hanging off his hips. It was like this big change. He tried really, really hard to fit in for a while, but the way that he looked brought him, you know, a lot of bullying. And not even before we were out of high school, his body was found at the bottom of a cliff. Of course, there were stories about whether or not he was pushed, whether or not he jumped. And again, it just kind of all went back to this thing. You know, he was involved in Satanism. The satanic panic thing was real. It was a really big deal back then. I think kids like that got into heavy metal and got into this, you know, persona that they were into Satanism. So people would leave him alone. They wanted to look tougher than they were. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. I think kids like that are sensitive and they're hurting. And life hurts less when you're hard on the outside, doesn't it? It hurts less than being soft and teased all the time. I think that's why a lot of people get hard on the outside. It's just less painful. I think even Ricky was in pain. Kids he went to school with said he was actually a really nice guy, but that he was just messed up. One girl said she used to take Gary food and she'd sit and talk with him for hours. She said he didn't hate his family, but that he was very angry with them. She asked if he had ever had a girlfriend and he told her, "I'm not into relationships. They never last." So that's a little insight into Ricky's mentality. He was scared of getting hurt. Ricky and Gary actually had a lot in common on that, but they were both on this downward spiral, this runaway train. And although I'm sure they had no idea at the time, they were both headed to the exact same destination. June 19th, 1984. Gary and a group of people are hanging out in a small gazebo at the Cow Harbor Park. Ricky Casso came walking up. He borrowed a radio from a friend and then invited Gary to go and get high with him. Jimmy and Albert went along too. The four walked out of the park towards Aztekia Woods, where they built a fire and set out some old chairs. The wood was wet from a recent rain and the fire kept going out. So as the group did hits of PCP, Gary took off his socks for kindling. When those didn't work, he tore off the sleeves to his denim jacket and used those to keep the fire going. Kind of a gesture that tells you he was trying to make the group happy, isn't it? The four guys had taken quite a bit of PCP, and just like they did so many other times before, they got into a fight. Ricky and Gary were really going at it, and suddenly Ricky grabbed Gary and bit him very hard on the neck like an animal would do. Gary was stunned, but he didn't really have time to think because Ricky pulled a knife from his jacket and stabbed Gary. Gary ran, but Ricky caught him. Ricky had dropped the knife and Jimmy picked it up and gave it back to Ricky. Ricky was in a frenzy. Gary fell to the ground, and as he did, Ricky began yelling at him, saying, "Say you love Satan," over and over and over. Gary would not say it. If you believe Albert Quinones, Jimmy Troiano helped Ricky hold Gary down, but did not take part in the actual stabbing. Albert also later reported that as Ricky was telling Gary, "Say you love Satan," Gary said instead, "I love my mother." Gary was stabbed over 20 times, and then Gary's eyes were gone. When it was over, Ricky and Jimmy covered Gary's body up with leaves and branches and left the woods. Over the next few days, Ricky Casso began bragging about murdering Gary. He told his friends that Satan had manifested to him in the woods, that he'd actually seen Satan. Ricky said that after he killed Gary, Satan came to him in the form of a black crow who cawed over and over. This let Ricky know that Satan was pleased. Oh, boy. Ricky talked openly about what he had done, but back then there was this kid code. I don't know if it still exists like it did back then, because only kids speak kid code. I'm not a kid. But back then, you did not tell adults what other kids did. It wasn't even that you were afraid of them getting mad at you. You just didn't tell. It wasn't okay to tell adults about kid stuff. So even though Ricky was openly bragging about what he had done, none of the adults knew. After about a week, a couple of kids told Ricky he was full of shit because if he had really killed Gary, the police would know by now. So Ricky actually took the kids to Gary's body and showed it to them. Ricky Casso really just did not care about his life. It doesn't feel like he cared if he got in trouble. It doesn't feel like he cared if bad things happened to him. He was gone. He actually once told his mother that death would be the ultimate high. He was really far gone, especially for a 16-year-old. After Ricky took these other kids to see Gary's body, he and Jimmy went back to the woods and buried Gary because of the smell. Gary's family was beside themselves, and Ricky was just out in town telling everyone that would listen that he was responsible, but nobody broke the kid code for a couple of weeks. Finally, on July 1st, 1984, a local girl called the police. She wouldn't give her name, but she told the operator that she knew Gary was dead and she knew who had killed him. July 4th, 1984. The police go into the woods and release their canines to begin sniffing the site the caller led them to, the site where she believed Gary Lowers was buried. The dog walked quickly around the area and the police knew there was a body nearby. The dog began to howl and then sat, indicating he had found human remains. A forensics unit was brought in and only a foot or so beneath the dirt, they found him. There was Gary Lowers, partially skeletonized in his Nikes and his running shorts, and what was once a denim jacket, now only a denim vest, because Gary had torn the sleeves off to keep the fire going that night. Police were able to get a fingerprint and confirm Gary's identity. They set about looking for Ricky and Jimmy, and the next day, on July 6th, they found them, sleeping in a car outside of one of their friends' houses. Ricky Casso and Jimmy Toriano were arrested and taken into custody. This footage of the arrest, of them being brought in, is the source for really the only photos that we have of Ricky Casso. Ricky and Jimmy were arraigned before Judge Gerard D'Amelio in Suffolk County Court. They were charged with second-degree murder, and they were ordered held without bail, and a hearing was set for 3 days later. They were then sent to the Suffolk County Jail in Riverhead. They were processed, and for their own protection, they were sent to individual cells inside the maximum security jail. Apparently, the jail was very overcrowded, with 800 prisoners in a space designed for only 600. The police were worried about the juveniles being in that overcrowded jail with adult prisoners. I guess Ricky and Jimmy had to go to jail for somebody to care about them. Later that night, just after midnight, correction officer Ronald Horton was making his usual rounds and saw Ricky sleeping in his cell. When he returned a half an hour later, he found Ricky hanging by a bedsheet, strung up from the upper bars of his cell. Ricky Casso was dead. He didn't leave a note. The prison went on lockdown, which is protocol when an inmate death occurs, and Jimmy Toriano was placed on 24-hour watch. Police officials were concerned that the two may have had some kind of a pact. As the news spread that Ricky was dead, there was a very strange reaction in the local area. Many parents were like, good riddance. Others were judgmental, saying Ricky's parents could have done this and could have done that, done more to prevent all of this. But the kids kind of took it to another level. Girls started wearing shirts with Ricky's photo on them. Others wore homemade shirts where they had written, Ricky lives, on them with marker. This, of course, made Gary's friends very angry. Gary's girlfriend said that she started wearing a shirt that said Gary lives in retaliation, and many students were angry that Ricky was made out to be some kind of anti-hero. The media had a field day with this story. Every night on the news for weeks and then months, there were stories about AC/DC and Judas Priest and Ozzy Osbourne because those were Ricky's favorite bands. Ricky was actually arrested wearing an AC/DC t-shirt. So, I mean, this was all the media needed to stoke the fires of satanic panic. Geraldo Rivera did an entire 2-hour special on satanic worship. I would love to play some of it for you, but it's copyrighted. So I will link it in the description of this video. This special is really something else. Really ridiculous garbage, like laughable stuff, embarrassing stuff. They even drag poor Ozzy on there via satellite from London to defend himself. They've got priests and Satan worshipers on the stage together, and it's all just very 80s. I'll just say that. This was the era of Reagan, the war on drugs, which is the greatest American failure since trickle-down economics. You had Tipper Gore releasing her book, Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. That's what the book was called. And it talked about how the world was going to hell in a handbasket because of rock lyrics and video games. Meanwhile, there were just a whole lot of kids being abused and neglected in their homes, but nobody wanted to get on TV and rant and rave about that. It was much easier to blame rock music and art and an invisible, spooky ghost man than our own parenting, right? With Ricky dead, that left Jimmy and Albert responsible for Gary's death. Albert quickly became a witness. He claims the police beat him up and harassed him even after he agreed to help, but he did end up giving the authorities the majority of the information they had on the case. Jimmy was set to go to trial, and he hired this attorney, Eric Nyberg, to represent him. Eric Nyberg quickly ran into a problem with his client. Jimmy couldn't keep his story straight. Every time Nyberg tried to prepare Jimmy for trial, he changed his story. So Nyberg took Jimmy to the woods and made him physically point out what had happened and where. Eric Nyberg took these photos of those outings. He said at one of them, Jimmy looked at him and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Nyberg. When the trees are melting and the stars are racing across the sky, it's hard to remember what happened." Jimmy's trial began a year after his arrest. Albert testified against him, but he was a terrible witness. Albert said Jimmy did hold Gary down, but he didn't know if he stabbed him. Now, here's a really crazy little bit. Albert had told police that he had taken a lot of drugs the night of the murder, and he had actually seen a lion in the woods. Later in court, Jimmy's attorney, who read that police statement about the lion, asked Albert if he had in fact seen a lion in the woods, and Albert said no. The attorney then said to Albert, "Oh, didn't you hear? There was a circus in town that night, and a lion had escaped from the circus." On the witness stand, Albert replied and said, "You mean that lion was really there?" So that shot Albert's credibility. He didn't know what he had seen that night. He was so high. There was no lion, and the jury pretty much had to discount his entire testimony. The medical examiner was brought in to testify, and he stated that the attack was most likely done by a single perpetrator. He testified as to Gary's wounds, and this too ended up helping Jimmy's case. After several weeks of testimony, the jury returned. Jimmy Troiano was found not guilty of second-degree murder, and he was set free.
When you and Ricky first met, you were in eighth grade or so.
Yeah.
And I just was wondering if you could tell us, how tight were you guys? How'd you feel? What kind of connection was there?
Started out playing. Trying to think when I actually met Ricky. It was junior high, seventh grade football. That's what it was. That's when I met Ricky, and then we'd play football after school. You know, tackle football with just the burnouts. And
right.
From there, I started hanging out with him at his house, and I met him. I knew him for like 3 years. You know, I went to a summer camp once. His parents had a camp, and that's where we ran up to the Sully Acid, up to his parents' camp. They weren't there, though. They were at home. We ran up because he knew everyone around the thing was Saratoga.
Right.
And he knew everyone up there, and we sold acid up there. I had other better friends that were probably better for me, you know, hanging out playing baseball or something, but doing the drugs and everything we did. He was there. We were together hanging out all the time. We used to go fishing and everything. I mean, but we'd be tripping fishing, yeah.
You said that to a lot of people. I mean, I think Ricky fascinates a lot of people. I think
that's it.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, they're interested in.
See, I wasn't really fascinated by him because I mean I'd done it before he met. I was already in 10 months or 12 months in prison, so. Nothing really fascinated me no more. I mean,
before you even met Ricky?
Yeah, I wasn't. Took a lot to enthuse me because I thought a lot of things were fake. I mean, being in prison is more realistic. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to explain, I guess. But
I couldn't find any information on what happened to Albert. Jimmy was arrested in 2004 for robbing a CVS pharmacy, but it appears he got his life back on track after that and is now married with children. The media wrote stories about how Ricky and Jimmy were devil worshippers and that they were in a cult. According to the people who were actually there, none of that is true. They were just a little group of lost souls trying to make their way through life, and they kind of all liked the same thing. People who were there even dispute the claims that any animals were killed or any of that. They say all of that is just made up for the sake of sensationalism. Years later, people remember this as a really sad mark on a nice little town that, yes, was rough around the edges and had its fair share of problems, but most of those problems had to do with what was happening in the homes and not what was happening on the streets. Has that changed? As you would expect, many songs were written about this story. Sudden Impact by Big Audio Dynamite, Satan is Boring by Sonic Youth, Bad Party by the Dead Milkmen, Crying Shame by Faster Pussycat, and many, many more were penned. There is a band called Acid King as well, and several books. Say You Love Satan was published in 1987, and The Acid King was published in 2018. There is a 2020 special called The Devil Worshippers that was produced in 1985 that talks about this and other Satanic Panic era cases. The Biography Channel did an episode on this story called Killer Kids for its series Occult Killers, and then there is a documentary for rent here on YouTube produced in 2021 called The Acid King. I rented it as part of my research for this episode. It has a lot of personal interviews with people who were actually there, people who knew Ricky and Gary and everyone else involved. It's quite an interesting documentary, and I'll put a link where you can rent it for $2 if you'd like. The 1980s were a decade like no other. I'm actually really grateful to have that decade be the decade where I became a teenager. We had fantastic fashion, we had great music, we had no cell phones or social media, and we had a lot of freedom. Our parents were making good money, the economy was booming, and people were generally prosperous. Isn't human nature a funny thing? In the decade where we had most of our needs met and a lot of our problems solved, we had to invent an imaginary problem to occupy our thoughts and our time. In an era where we should have been happy about the fact that things were going so well, where after decades of war, we had the resources to solve real problems with real solutions, we instead turned all of the blame over to a scary ghost man we pretended was the source of anything really and actually violent. Instead of looking inward at what was causing kids to be unhappy and violent, what pain they were trying to numb with drugs, we chose to look outward and to blame things that are never to blame for anyone's actions or anyone's pain. My friends, I hate to tell you this, but it's been over 30 years and that hasn't changed at all. Thank you for joining me on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Like the video if you liked it, and subscribe to my channel if you'd like to see more from me. You can also support me by joining my Patreon, and there will be some bonus content there very soon. Stay safe and be kind to each other, and I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.